ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Where is individual style and design born? For me, it's always been something that we take from the real world around us. But increasingly, it's something that we find through different forms of media, online, in magazines, on the TV. We're exposed to more images than ever before, scrolling through Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube every day. Which makes me wonder, are our personal design choices really our own? Or are they always being shaped by the algorithm? Hello, I'm Anthony Burke, and this is ABC Radio National.
I thought it was inspiring. You know, you can really see what's trending. You could pull a lot of ideas together very quickly, and it's endless scrolling possibilities as well. So, you know, with a magazine, it's only got so many pages, then it's done. You have to wait for another month for the next edition to come out. So I found social media very, very helpful. Where it probably did me in was the overwhelm. In my particular case, I liked too many things. I had too many styles that I was fond of, and I did not know how to pull it together.
That's Sandra, a Melburnian renovating her kitchen and bathroom with her husband. It's a familiar story for many of us. If you want inspiration, you turn to the place that offers you a smorgasbord of choice, social media. But how much of what you see when you're scrolling is based on your own individual sense of style, and how much is being fed to you by the algorithm? And on the other hand, isn't it about giving us access to the tastemakers, interior designers that we otherwise couldn't afford? Is social media a positive thing for design, or is it killing individuality?
I think it's great for the designers to find inspiration and to find makers. I think it's terrible for the clients because it confuses them no end.
In terms of democratization of design, people like me would never have a platform if it wasn't for YouTube. And so I think that in that sense, by eliminating those gatekeepers, I think we've sort of kind of opened it up to a whole lot of different voices that can be heard.
Today, we're lifting the lid on interior design in the age of social media. From an interior decorator helping clients define their own style, to a YouTube influencer broadcasting design inspiration, to nearly 800,000 followers, we're exploring the role today's tastemakers play in shaping what our homes look like.
The way that I describe what I do is if you were to tip your home upside down, everything that falls out is my area of expertise and it's my love, it's my passion. My following does to some degree give credibility. It gives credibility to brands, beautiful brands like Porsche who have worked with me, as well as, you know, some really great fashion labels.
Simone Haig is an interior decorator who works with individual clients and has a significant presence on Instagram with 92,000 followers. For Simone, Instagram is both a resource and a shopfront, helping her discover artisans and craftspeople while showcasing her work to potential clients. But while social media may bring clients through the door, she says it doesn't dictate the outcome. Each project, she says, is shaped by the unique character of the home and the people who live in it.
All the projects are very different. I like to think of myself as a chameleon. I don't have a particular style. The recipe is the same in terms of it might be a series of vintage and new, or it's very layered. It's executed end to end. So it's not just the objects, it's the art, it's the styling pieces, it's the whole curation. But for me, my role is trying to interpret what the client wants and reflecting back to them what they want, while still being forward-thinking in design. So invariably my clients won't brief me with a series of images and say, I want this, which is great. They'll say, I love your work. Here's my home. Where can we take this? And I try where I can. I try and say, if you can avoid it or if you don't need to, don't send me briefing images. Don't send me your Pinterest board. Let me respond. I don't want to see the project through their lens. I want to see it through my own lens first. So, whereas I feel if they've overbriefed me, and it starts to box the designer in. So I say, where possible, try not to give those early constraints.
All right. So in that whole process, try and bring the social media then into this kind of dimension of your professional life. What is social media to you in that way?
It's very much a way of sourcing product because I love what I do so much and it's never a job for me. It's like I don't sort of say I'm going to sit down and do some research now. Like I'm always researching. Every time I see someone walking down the street and I love a color of their jacket, or if I'm on Instagram and I see a beautiful piece of furniture, or I'm following a particular trade fair, like I'm constantly cataloging ideas. And I have to be honest, Instagram is a great way for me to do that. So I find it a great source of inspiration. I also find it a great source of frustration because I think the audience these days, and I mean this with the greatest respect, they're lazy viewers. They're not looking at a post of a particular designer or someone else who is a decorator and scrutinizing and going, well, is that their work? Is that a work that they just like? Is that inspiration? Is that a render? Is that, then what probably people don't realize is to have that end product on your page as your work. That took 18 months to get there.
Simone's work is not just in helping a client choose pieces that together make their place feel like a home. It's coordinating all the various elements to land and settle into place. She's not only managing the sourcing of objects, she's working with relationships and logistics as well. She's engaging on both a practical and an emotional level. It's what she sees as setting herself apart from an online interior influencer.
Well, I think the influencer is being, so say you've been given a certain budget to tout a certain project, it's not necessarily always an honest alignment. It might be a financial alignment. So I think an influencer, how can I say this in a nice way, but I feel like they can, we're on Tinder, they're an influencer, they're swiping left, they're swiping right, they're swiping left, they're swiping right. They're sort of like they're engaging with everyone, they're going on all these dates, they're sharing all these products. And at the end of the day, have they really found their future Mr. and Mrs. or Mrs. Right? Probably not. And I guess the reasons for them promoting that product comes, generally speaking, the motivation for touting those products comes from a financial incentive to do so. For me, I have a lot of boxes to tick. I have clients that may have existing pieces that they need to incorporate. They have a budget that needs to be adhered to. They have some briefing cues about family or pets or how they like to live or things that they love or hate. I have a whole suite of furniture I've got to assemble that's complemented by objects and art. I have all of these competing requirements. And at the end of the day, what I produce for the client, it's not about how it's going to look on my feed as much as that is something that I'm not going to lie pops into my head from time to time, but I've been engaged by them to prepare a home for them.
For Simone Haig, social media is a tool that can ultimately help deliver a better result for her clients. Working with the specific qualities of each home, she uses platforms like Instagram to discover artisans, makers, and unique pieces that can bring a space to life. But she says social media can also be limiting. When clients arrive with a long list of saved images and reference shots, it can constrain the design process, making it harder to respond to the particular character of a home and create something truly individual. Rather than replicating what already exists online, Simone's goal is to develop a design that reflects the people who live there and the space itself.
My job as a creator or an influencer is more of a media company that just happens to be about interior design, right? So it's more about creating content and working with editors and brand partnerships and affiliate links and all sorts of different ways you can monetize and figuring out trends. It's really more of a media job or a media company.
Nick Lewis has an interior design channel on YouTube with almost 800,000 followers. Unlike an interior decorator like Simone Haig, who uses social media as a resource to support her work, social media is Nick's business. His content isn't simply informed by social media, it exists for it. His audience, reach, and income all depend on the platform. In that sense, Nick isn't primarily designing homes, he's producing media about design.
So there's a few ways creators make money, three main ways really. On a platform like YouTube, the first is AdSense, which is there's the skippable ad that sort of works at the beginning of a video, right? And that's all YouTube. I don't know what those ads are. They're different for every user. That's kind of their secret sauce and why they're worth billions of dollars. But basically when that ad plays, let's say it's Lululemon, basically that Lululemon pays money to YouTube and then YouTube pays money to me. And that's called AdSense. And that is a check that arrives every every month that is basically based on views. So the higher views that I have, essentially, the more money that I'm going to make through AdSense. The second is what's called an affiliate link, which is if I, let's say, talk about a certain product, like Amazon, for example, if you click on the link in the description and you go and make a purchase on Amazon, Amazon gives me a very small percentage and you don't pay any more as the person who clicks, but I get a little bit of a kickback. That's why you see on some of these platforms like TikTok and Instagram, a lot of people talking about like what I buy on Amazon and my favorite Amazon hauls. And that's why you see a lot of that content, because people are listing a bunch of stuff that you can then purchase and they can collect a small commission. And then the third is a brand partnership. So that is when a brand comes to me and says, hey, Nick, we'd love to for you personally to endorse the product in one of your videos, and we'll pay you a certain amount of money, a flat fee, basically, to run like a 30-second ad or 60-second ad inside your video. So it's in my own voice, it's to camera, and I basically do an ad read in addition to the AdSense that I talked about before. So those are the three main ways that creators make money.
Knowing all that, can I really trust what Nick is telling me in his videos? Is he sharing legitimate design advice, or is it just something he's been paid to do? I've watched some of Nick's videos and they all look very genuine to me. So how does the average person know if he's the authority to listen to?
Like, I try to be very transparent and quite honest about it by saying I'm not an interior designer and that I just am a guy in his living room sharing his opinion. And take it or leave it, and yeah, that's fine. There's a lot of people that can disagree, and that's part of the fun. So to me, it's kind of, I mean, people say they learn a lot, which is great. I share what I know and what I've learned over the years. And by doing this for 6 years, I know a lot more now than I even did 6 years ago about design, which is a good thing. But yeah, I think people should be careful about what they're consuming. And not to touch into all this, but I mean, when dealing with issues around, you know, finances or health or whatever, we've seen that who you trust and who are the authorities on the subject can be challenging. I think in the world of design, it's not as life-threatening, and so perhaps maybe not as much of a thing. But I always encourage people, I think, to be aware, but I don't know if they always know. I don't think people do. I think if you put something on the internet and you speak with authority and you look like you know what you're talking about, like I did 6 years ago, I think people do believe it.
Yeah.
And I'm being self-deprecating. I mean, I did know a little bit, I guess, obviously, but at the same time, I mean, I was learning as I went about design as I was sharing. And, you know, I hope people learned, and I hope I didn't lead people down the wrong path into making stupid design decisions over the years. But again, it's sink or swim. If people watch you and it's engaging, you'll get traction on these platforms, whether you know what you're talking about or not. I mean, hopefully the audience votes with their click and good content rises to the top. But what is good content, I suppose, is not necessarily accurate content. And that's sometimes maybe the challenge.
Do you think that social media in general is a negative or a positive in that sort of way of thinking about it?
I would say in terms of democratization of design, people like me would never have a platform if it wasn't for YouTube. I can promise you 6 years ago when I had no credentials, nothing to talk about, to be honest, like truly, there was no network in the world that would have given me the time of day to give me 5 minutes on air, right? It just wouldn't have happened. So it's really kind of sink or swim. So either you kind of like have good content and good ideas, or you don't. And so I think that in that sense, by eliminating those gatekeepers, I think we've sort of kind of opened it up to a whole lot of different voices that can be heard. But of course, the negative can be these platforms really do push people towards copying one another and following trends. And that's built into the platform. I've seen, you know, even in the 6 years that I've been doing this, which I know is not long to have a career on something, but I will say I've seen huge changes even since 2020, right? TikTok has meant it promotes copying. Like if you watch a piece of content and you enjoy it, you engage with it, you watch it, TikTok goes, well, we just want you to stay on the platform, right? So we don't really care what you watch. So why don't you watch the same thing over again? You know what I mean? You'll watch another creator do the exact same thing. And so YouTube's doing the same thing. Instagram does the same thing. And so what happens is it's a good strategy to copy because that is what the platforms want. So if I have a video, let's say, on like top 10 favorite IKEA products or something on my channel, other creators in the space would be silly not to do their own top 10 versions. And so I think what you see is sort of this coalescing of design where you just sort of kind of see this sort of groupthink kind of happen where someone says something's trendy and that does well. And then the next thing you know, you kind of see these good ideas sort of flow into other content.
At the same time that these trends promote a homogenized aesthetic in interior design, they also encourage a form of relentless consumerism. If you're following someone for their taste, you're often following someone whose livelihood depends on selling a particular lifestyle, or at least the products that go with it. But as Nick points out, influencers and their audiences aren't on equal footing. Keeping up with the latest products and trends is part of his job. He may be given products to review or even be paid to talk about them. His audience, meanwhile, is being encouraged to purchase those same products. Which means that while social media can feel like a source of inspiration, it's also a marketplace, and influencers and consumers occupy very different roles within it.
If I have a brand that wants to give me a new chair, right, a new side chair, I can get the chair, like, and I'm just, let's just be honest about it. I can get the chair for free. There's an affiliate link, which means if you click on the link in the description to get that chair, I can make a commission on that chair. And potentially, because I'm at the size that I am, a brand might pay me to take the chair. So they might do what's called like a brand integration. So now I'm making money and I can turn around and sell the chair because you're not keeping track of if I have that chair anymore. I sell the chair and make money on that. I make money on the affiliate link and I got paid by the brand to take it. So you on the other side of that screen are watching this thinking, oh, that's a really great chair. So, you know, that's why I always caution people. You cannot out-consume me. Like I have to be very careful in my job because you can, if you're not too careful, run the risk of just creating this flywheel of consumption. And that can alienate your audience who is spending a lot of hard-earned dollars and trying to get that chair. And so I think people should be mindful of that, and they're not.
So what about dupes? I mean, in that sense, do platforms like YouTube and TikTok, do they really encourage this idea of purchasing dupes?
Well, dupes, I think, yes. Well, creators ultimately, I think, have a challenge there, right? Because on one hand, like, I think there is something really powerful as a creator when you tell people, like, follow me and I can share a find. Like, don't be fooled by this really expensive designer piece. You don't need that. What instead, you're going to buy this and it's super, super cheap. And this is like where the smart people are going to buy the product, right? So you establish trust with your audience because now you're seen as an authority on a person who can get you a good deal, which is always attractive, especially in this economy, right? So I do think that there is, so do the platforms encourage it? I don't think the platforms care, to be honest. I think they might in the sense that if something is designer, you're probably not going to attach an affiliate link to it and be able to collect a commission, whether it's a creator or a platform like TikTok Shop or any of these things, because they're in this game as well now. So yeah, dupes, you know, you might find something really expensive designer piece. The designer might make a lot of money off of selling one of those, but chances are the platforms aren't going to sell very many and not make very much money on it if they do, because it's not going to get an affiliate link or a commission if you sell it. But, you know, if it shows up on a mainstream sort of retailer, that is something now like an Amazon or a Wayfair or something like that, that is something you can hop on and you can collect a commission, which of course is only going to entice creators more. So there's a financial incentive. There's also a bit of a way to develop a relationship with your audience that way, because you're now seen as someone who's in the know in terms of where to get a good deal.
So when you look at a feed on TikTok or YouTube, you could be snagging a great deal, but it's more likely the product you're buying is a knockoff and not from the original creator. Alternatively, when you look at Simone Haig's feed, what she's collected for her clients come from makers and creatives direct.
I really love to involve artisans, makers, creatives, because I think the more creatives in a room, the better the outcome. So when I invite someone to collaborate on something, I definitely wouldn't say that I'm documenting it, passing it to them and saying, build this, make this. So I really love giving my creative partners some opportunity to bring their style into the project. I love when clients can go visit these makers and see pieces that are in production. They can look at the makers' showrooms or workshops or warehouses. I see myself as a little bit of a conductor of an orchestra, and the orchestra might be furniture pieces, but it's also the musicians and letting them be part of that overall composition is really important for me, as opposed to just purely dictating, for want of a better word.
So do you get a commission from different stores and suppliers?
Absolutely. Yes, I'm really clear with clients about how our commission structure works. So I see that there's two phases in this process, and one phase is the design work, and then one is actually the project management. We do the design work, but what we do is obviously making beautiful selections, but so much of it is placing the orders, overseeing those, overseeing the timing. So that commission that we do make on the furniture purchases pays for all of that ongoing support. It pays for us sourcing art and objects and making beds. It supports us that, you know, 2, 3, 4 years later, if there's a problem, we may not be able to get them a refund, but we can certainly advocate for them. And you know, if my client contacts the supplier, they may get a response. If we do, we do get a response, because no one's going to want to bite the hand that feeds them in terms of support.
Both Simone and Nick, in very different ways, can benefit financially from recommending a product, which is no surprise. But the bigger question is, how do those incentives shape the tastes and purchasing decisions of the public? An interior decorator, like Simone, might recommend a piece to a client as part of a one-on-one relationship. But social media operates at a completely different scale. When an influencer promotes a product, that recommendation can be amplified by algorithms, repeated across feeds, and shown again and again to people who have already demonstrated an interest in a particular look or lifestyle. What begins as a single recommendation can become a feedback loop, one that reaches thousands, even millions of people. It's in those feedback loops built into the architecture of social media that trends are reinforced and certain styles come to dominate. So, doesn't that make the algorithm the biggest tastemaker of all? But, as with most things, the story isn't so simple. For designers, it's a source of inspiration. For audiences, it's opened the doors to a world that was once largely reserved for professionals and enthusiasts. Nick Lewis again.
I'm going to say overall, and again, I'm acknowledging my bias, I'm going to say overall it has democratized design. And it's design has always been something where, you know, let's be honest, it's always been a premium thing. Most people will never be able to afford an architect or an interior designer. It's they are a wonderful, amazing value if you can afford it, but they are an expensive solution to your specific problems. They will come in and you will get a beautiful space by the end, assuming you hire the right designer, the one that you connect with and whatever. So, you know, I do think that there is a lot of space that was neglected by interior designers for good reason, because designers aren't really appealing to people that can't afford their services because they don't need to. That's not how their business works, right? So I do think that what it's done is it's given space to people that can provide general advice for, you know, a wide audience. And I think overall that is a good thing.
Back in Melbourne, Sandra says that while the sheer volume of inspiration online could sometimes feel overwhelming, social media ultimately made the process of designing her bathroom and kitchen easier and more enjoyable.
I'd have to say that, you know, it's good, because I don't want a house full of magazines that I've collected over the years to try and get the inspiration that I want. Like social media, you can go down any rabbit hole, you can follow any design path and you get immediate feedback, and I think that's been really fun and really helpful. I'm starting to see that it has its issues too, but no, I wouldn't reverse it. I wouldn't undo that. I can't imagine doing it without it.
I have to admit, when it comes to design benefits, I'm something of a social skeptic. And in particular with architecture and design, my sense is that while they make broader access to design ideas available, they also reduce design in most people's minds to two dimensions, when we know it's about much more. Research suggests it's no coincidence that the rise of the Starkitect and the international iconic building phenomenon was aligned with the evolution of the World Wide Web. So, while this is not particularly new in design, my worry is that socials have accelerated this side of architecture and design to the point where we've started to create a world where decisions are made for web-ready designs rather than experiential ones. That we can see actual buildings being built to create Insta moments means we're now literally building stage sets for the algorithm, both at home and out in public buildings, feeding a virtual audience with an attention span on average of about 2.7 seconds, rather than promoting a real lived experience in all its richness, something an image can't catch. And of course, after the dopamine hit of the image fades, all of us are left to live with the design for years to come. You've been listening to By Design. Follow the podcast to catch future episodes and listen out for our bonus series, Extraordinary Everyday, released every Thursday. Next time on By Design, Aussies love their pets, but just how far would you go to keep your cat happy.
I've had one enclosure where, with the tunnels, a lady had a pond in her garden. So we got the tunnel from the window down to the ground so the cat could go around the pond and look at the fish in the pond and then go back into the house again.
That's next time on By Design, because in a rapidly changing world, design matters.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.